The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Hearn. On this week's show...
To call her a troll, I think that we would be pushing that term again far beyond the boundary of what it can cope with.
The complex issue of internet trolling was brought into stark relief this week as an alleged perpetrator is believed to have taken her own life after a Sky TV investigation. We hear from an expert on internet trolls, Dr. Claire Hardiker, on why people engage in this damaging and potentially illegal activity. Also, the tech team and I discussed news this week that PC manufacturer HP is to split into H and P. Well, it's a bit more complex than that, so stay tuned for our discussion. And finally, we'll be talking about the launch of Tesco's newest own brand tablet, the Huddle 2. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined in the studio this week by Samuel Gibbs. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
And down the line by Charles Arthur.
Hello.
Charles, we kick off this week with the announcement of a big technology firm breaking up. It's the opposite of what we normally hear, which is them merging together. Tell us more about this.
So Hewlett-Packard, which is in many ways the iconic Silicon Valley company, started in a garage with Hewlett and Packard. So two founders, like so many other companies, you know, like Apple before it and Google, has announced that it's going to split by the end of 2015 into two companies. There'll be a printing and PC company, which will be called HP Inc., INC, although you can sort of get the pun in the sound of it, and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. They're actually spelling out the Hewlett-Packard. So you've got HP and you've got Hewlett-Packard, which will be all the sort of enterprise-y vague things. So services, servers, software, financial services, all those sorts of things. All the things that basically you can't drop on your foot.
Why did the company need to split in the first place?
Well, this is an interesting question, but there seem to be two reasons for it. The first is that HP had really got so big. It was one of the biggest technology companies in terms of headcount, but also in terms of revenues in the world. And this meant, I think, that its spirit of innovation, the thing that had really made it special in years gone by, was lacking, and also was basically being crushed by the fact of the bureaucracy of being such a big company. And so for that reason, I think that Meg Whitman's desire as chief executive to break the company up makes some sense, because it's much easier to do things, to change quickly, to change course, to, you know, come up with new ideas if you've got a small company than if you've got a big one. But at the same time, the printer and the PC businesses, the HP Inc., those are the ones which really look like they are, if not in the twilight years, they're certainly a maturing market, and one where one can't really see a great deal of growth. It's rather like what IBM did in 2005 when it sold off its PC business to Lenovo, where the printer business, if you actually look at the revenues, hasn't been growing for a long time now. And the PC business, very much the same. You know, the margins are okay in the printer business. They're pretty lousy in the PC business. But when it comes to the overall landscape of PCs and printers, you would say that's not actually a growth market. So the sort of enterprise cloud servers business that's going to be left behind is Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, actually has a much better prospect going for it.
So if this is part of the wider story about the death of the PC, what's the prognosis for HP Inc.? Are they a must-drop-your-investment-now company?
Well, one would have to say that it's not a company that you would think is really going to set the world alight, although they've talked about things like we can see all possibilities in 3D printing, other things, Internet of Things, that sort of stuff. You know, there's plenty to be said, and given that the printing business is, you know, has got good margins, they can certainly generate the cash flow for it. But you have to wonder, you know, if they don't get some hits with new technologies early on, then they might struggle as the PC business gets smaller, because HP very much missed the mobile wave. It wasn't in there with tablets. It had the touchpad and then dumped it. And it's never been in the mobile business.
I was going to ask Sam, actually, about, you know, you see gadgets passing through your desk on a daily basis. When was the last time HP did anything that you thought it was worth putting attention to?
Well, they originally made some decent ultrabooks. The HP Envy line was probably the best of that. But you're right. They've not been innovating innovating in the kind of mobile space. I mean, I remember when they were the kings of the pocket PC, for crying out loud. But that died, and then, I mean, they bought Compaq again, another king of the pocket PC. They just seemed to sit on their laurels. And, you know, they went with WebOS, which was great, but then they kind of bottled it.
Then died as well.
And then they bought Palm, and then, oh, I don't know. To be honest, it looks like, if you look at the PC leaders now, Lenovo is right at the top. It's a giant, but it also has that innovative spirit. It's looking at, you know, these kind of like hybrid machines, and it's doing all sorts of different models and ways of approaching the PC. And enterprise seems to be interested in it just as much as users. So HP needs to get back to that.
Now, from a company trying to break things up to a company trying to use tech to merge key strands of its retail business together. This week, Tesco launched the second iteration of its own brand tablet, the Huddle, naming it Huddle 2. Sam, you were suitably impressed with the first incarnation of the Tesco tablet, which is definitely how they don't want us to refer to it. How does the Huddle 2 stand up in comparison?
So the first one was really quite a novel thing, a supermarket launching a tablet that both wasn't rubbish and was affordable. Yes, you're right. I was almost shocked, which is difficult these days. The Huddle 2 is kind of like a follow-on. It is less interesting in the fact that they have history here now, but it's more interesting in the fact that they've basically, the first Huddle was almost like a secondary device. They pitched it as you've got an iPad or you've got another machine, buy this one, it's cheap and it won't break, and you know, you can do what you need to do with it, or you can give it to the kids, or it can be that kitchen tablet, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas the Huddle 2, all their kind of positioning seems to indicate that this is much more a primary device. Tesco wants this to be your tablet, the tablet that you have, not necessarily the second one. And they've gone about that in the technology is definitely improved. It has a much better screen. It's a thinner device. It's an 8.3 inch full HD display, whereas the old one was a 7 inch and it was only 720p. It is crisper and it's a nicer display. They've made some interesting choices. That the tablet runs on an Intel Atom chip. Most tablets and smartphones, they run on an ARM-based chip, which is a more power-efficient processor, and that's one of the reasons you get longer battery life. And whether Intel's chips are capable of doing that, we don't know. Not many tablets use an Intel Atom chip that aren't a PC, at least. So it's interesting. The Tesco Huddle found success last year because you could, not only was it £120, which was pretty cheap for a tablet in those days, and it's still relatively cheap now. This one's £129, but you can get it in Tesco club card vouchers, and that's the real killer thing here. If you're a Tesco customer and you have a stack of loyalty card vouchers, you can get it for £65, and that's an absolute bargain.
So bigger, better, and cheaper. I mean, with the last one, with the Huddle, you suggested it was the perfect tablet for older people and children. Is that still your conclusion second time round?
I suggested that it would be a good starter tablet. And the same is the case here. Tesco's actually gone further than most manufacturers in putting kind of like these almost startup advice apps that show you how to use bits and pieces, which is sadly lacking from quite a lot of the tablets. And I mean, pretty much any gadget you buy these days does not come with a paper manual. I mean, when was the last time you actually saw a proper manual like the olden days? And when you actually start getting to use it, it's meant to be intuitive enough that you don't need any manual. But for quite a lot of people, that's just simply not the case, especially if this is the first interaction they've had with Android and an Android tablet. So Tesco's gone and created like these kind of pointer apps and how to get the best out of. And they've also gone even further. They've partnered with the Parent Zone. So the previous Huddle had kind of like, it was designed for the family in mind. This one goes way further. The Parent Zone is kind of like an advice bureau for parenting on the internet. And they've partnered with Tesco to do this kind of filtered access to the tablet. I mean, we've had loads of filters before, especially at the ISP level. But what they've done is they've gone to such a fine grain level, like any sort of topic you can filter out from the browser. You can say which apps they can and can't use. And you can even set time limits for children's accounts on the screen time limits. So, you know, if you only want your kid to use the tablet between, I don't know, 4 and 6 every day, that's possible. But say you only want them to use it for a total of 2 hours throughout the whole day, again, that's possible. It's a really good way of doing it. I think it looks good.
I thought the emphasis on the children's control there did suggest to me that the Tesco felt there's a gap in the market there, something which, you know, the iPad really doesn't do, and which other Android tablets perhaps don't do as well. And they've really put a lot of effort into it, clearly seeing that there's a potential market to be tapped there for people who say, yeah, well, I've got a tablet already, but yes, I really want to do parental controls on tablets because these things just get out of control too far.
You've raised kids with iPads yourself, Charles. Are these features something that you actually look at and think, God, you know, I wish I'd had that when I first handed a tablet over to my child?
I think it's very useful. Yes, I mean, one thing it can't do, and what I think is an eternal bugbear of parents, to be honest, is it can't do filters on YouTube. And YouTube's biggest problem is that it has no sort of segmentation. You know, everyone under 18 is assumed to be in effect the same person, which means that you can't quite leave kids of any age alone with a tablet, because, you know, once they get onto YouTube, then things can quickly spiral out of control, let us say. So I think that there's still a gap there which Google hasn't closed, which actually it should do something about. And, you know, improvements to the YouTube apps on tablets of any stripe would actually be very useful there.
I mean, Sam, this is a good tablet, an amazing tablet coming from a supermarket. What about just, is it an amazing tablet? Should other tablet makers be casting a wary eye at Tesco's direction, or are they getting easy marks for being an unusual source of tablets?
You see, the first time round, yes, they were getting marks for being an unusual source. The second time round, no. Well, and we've seen in the level of interest in the Huddle 2 is different to the first time round. The novelty factor's worn off. But they're still making cost-effective tablets that get the basics right. And we'll have a review of the Huddle 2 in the next week or so. But my general first impressions feeling is that it's a tablet that will do most of what most people want to do with a tablet. It's not an iPad killer, but it might be a Nexus 7 killer, for instance, Google's cheaper 7-inch tablet. And any in that kind of space, they've got food for thought here, definitely.
But if Tesco is doing well at digital in this end, in the hardware end, they don't seem to be doing quite so well elsewhere. We've heard rumours that the company's Netflix rival, Blinkbox, faces the chop. Does that sound plausible to you, Sam?
To be honest, when they bought Blinkbox, it was an interesting move. Blinkbox, for those who don't know, is a video streaming service, but instead of being a subscription service, it's a pay-as-you-go service. So you pay £3.50 and you can stream the latest blockbuster movie. And they get movies ahead of the DVD rental market and ahead of the likes of Netflix and things that are technically classified as the second pay TV window. So they're in the same ballpark as Sky, I guess. And the service started off as a bit rocky. It is now very good, but it doesn't have good public awareness. Blinkbox, to me, does not scream on-demand movies. It got some really good titles with things like Game of Thrones. It was the first place you could digitally get Game of Thrones, legally at least. And, you know, but whether it's generating money, it's we don't know whether it's generating money. The rumours, reports have recently said that, you know, with the mess that Tesco's in at the moment on the financial side and the turmoil that's caused, they're looking at all areas of the business, and Blinkbox has been identified as one of the weaker ones, which should be either boosted, which is probably where the Huddle comes in. I mean, that was one of their original pushes, you know, buy the Huddle, rent movies through Blinkbox, or basically put up for sale. We don't know for sure yet, though.
Charles, you had the opportunity to put these questions to Tesco's head of digital. Is BlinkBox for the chop? Would that take the Huddle with it if it was? Or could the tablet save the life of the rest?
Michael Komish really wouldn't comment on BlinkBox. He said, yes, I've seen the rumours, and he wouldn't comment on it, which to some extent is a comment, because if they were assured of its future, then I think he'd be saying, no, BlinkBox is completely safe in our hands. So I think that Tesco is taking a very long, hard look at it, in the context of being a company where it seems to have overstated its profits by £250 million and all sorts of other things are being considered. So, yes, I think that there's certainly a big, big question mark hanging over BlinkBox. One other interesting thing that Komish said was that they had considered doing a smartphone and decided not to, which I think is interesting in the context of Amazon, which has put out a Fire Phone after much consideration, and which has been poorly reviewed, most recently by Sam, and which, according to my own calculations, has sold very poorly as well. So I think Tesco may have done a rather wise thing there in not making a smartphone, because the market really is one where it's so crowded that it's difficult to stand out from the noise. But with tablets, there's still some opportunity.
Well, keep up on all of the rest of the Huddle news, as well as Tesco's digital plans, at theguardian.com/technology.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This week, an alleged internet troll, Brenda Leyland, was found dead in her hotel room, days after being confronted by a Sky News reporter about her alleged trolling of the McCann family on Twitter. But was Leyland even a troll? On the surface, it might seem so, but looking at her case in detail reveals little in common with other famous trolls, and its tragic ending suggests hidden complexity. Dr. Claire Hardacre is an expert in computer-mediated communication in the area of trolling, cyberbullying, and grooming. She joins us to try to understand the issues that trolling turns up. Claire, before we start, could you just give us an overview of what we mean by trolling? It seems to be a fantastically argued over term.
It's definitely a term that's been argued over a great deal now. It's one of those terms that sort of seems to have come to the fore in the media. And at one point, it seemed to have a reasonably clear definition. It sort of meant causing mayhem, causing aggravation online, usually for your own entertainment. And then as time has progressed, it seems to have stretched both ways. It's gone on to mean really serious things like death threats and bomb threats at one extreme. But then at the other extreme, it's also started to be used for things like just being annoying, just being someone who disagrees all the time. So this term has really gone beyond its natural boundaries, if you like, and it's almost become a bit of a useless term to try and use.
So, I mean, to the extent that that's true, how does one speak in generalities about trolling?
Well, we have to sort of, I mean, obviously your first question is, how do you define trolling? If you want to try and put a definition on that, if you want to try and sort of hark back to the slightly older version, you can talk about this, you know, aggravating people online for your own entertainment. Once you start getting down to that, you can find lots of different motives for reasons why people might do this, sort of background ideas that they might have about what they're trying to achieve when they're doing this. Beyond that, you can't necessarily stereotype too much about the kind of person themselves. You can't just say, this is all angry young men, or this is all, you know, people who are disenfranchised. We do actually find when we look at convictions that it's quite a range of different people, that it can be females, it can be older people, even people who seem to be quite successful.
When we talk about looking at who is convicted for it, is that a subset of trolling, or do you think that every aspect of trolling comes under criminal law in some way?
I think that we have to be really sort of careful about how we apply criminal law to behaviour that might be considered as trolling. So even if you take that sort of middle ground definition that I sort of gave out, you know, people being aggravating online for entertainment, one of the things that you have to consider is that there are all kinds of people out there, journalists, celebrities, comedians, who deliberately aggravate people, whose entire purpose is to cause upset, to cause mayhem. I mean, we talk about clickbait headlines, and they're deliberately antagonistic to drive traffic to the site. So we can't necessarily prosecute for behavior that's annoying, even offensive, because you have that issue of chilling of freedom of speech, and you don't want to encroach on freedom of speech. But where I think you sort of move into this sort of awkward gray area is when it starts to become more than just annoying, more than just offensive, maybe more than just political maneuvering or trying to get something to happen, where people are being gratuitously, grossly offensive. And there's some point, it's very difficult to sort of pinpoint when that is, when it needs to start becoming something that we look at with legislation, that we start dealing with criminal offences.
Now, I'd like to talk about this week's case. Obviously, the specifics are still unclear, but it does illustrate how splitting trolling into the troller and the trolled might be too simplistic. Trolling can be damaging for both parties. Is that right?
I would agree. And if we're talking about the case specifically of Brenda Leyland, I think one of the things that we have to really bear in mind with this case is when you look at her tweets, when you look at her behaviour, certainly you would be concerned with her behaviour. You would think that this is a person who perhaps needs some assistance, maybe needs some mental health assistance going on there. But when you look at her tweets, it's very difficult to find things in there that you would say that is trolling. Again, if we go back to this definition of causing aggravation for entertainment, deliberately annoying people, she didn't seem to be doing that. As far as her data goes, she looked like she was campaigning for what she felt was a miscarriage of justice, that she was trying to bring about a justice for this little girl who had been abducted or kidnapped. So in this case, when we're sort of trying to apply this definition of trolling, for Brenda Leyland, that definition doesn't really seem to fit.
And so you'd be uncomfortable about even calling her a troll from the off?
Absolutely. I mean, to call her a troll, I think that we would be pushing that term again far beyond the boundary of what it can cope with. In this case, you have a person who has an unpleasant opinion, definitely. She has an unpopular opinion. She says things about the McCanns that are not very nice. She calls them fools and accuses them of making money out of their daughter's disappearance. So does she have unpleasant opinions? Absolutely. But do all of us have an opinion that someone else would find unpleasant? Almost certainly. So do we have to protect the right for someone to have an unpleasant opinion? I think we absolutely do. Where we need to start to think about whether or not it's an issue is where it goes beyond the reasonable boundaries of, you know, harassing other people, attacking other people, forcing other people to accept that opinion. And to me, it doesn't seem like she does any of those things.
With social media evolving, I mean, is this a case of working out how to apply the boundaries that we are already used to an online world? Or do we need to come up with entirely new standards of behaviour before we can even think about how to apply legislation?
I think there's definitely, it's probably a 50-50 answer to those. I think we've got this issue of recognising the kind of behaviour that is acceptable online, and certainly different things will fly online that you cannot do face-to-face. Different things are funny online that you can't do offline, and so forth. And then once we've kind of come to a sort of an acceptance of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, once we've sort of established our norms, if you will, then I think we need to start looking at legislation. And one of the things that I've been saying for a while now is that when we look at the Communications Act of 2003, it was enforced before the advent of Facebook, before the advent of Twitter, long before the advent of Twitter. And so it wasn't written with that kind of internet in mind. It was written with the internet of the late 90s in mind. So it's unsurprising that when we look at cases, you know, going through sort of the Peter Nunns and so forth of the trolling history, that sometimes we get cases that fall between the gaps because legislation isn't really adequate enough at this point, I don't think, to deal with what we're looking at online.
Something that always comes up in debates about trolling is where power lies. Is there some element of the little guy trying to take back power which is normally vested in celebrities and famous people to trolling?
I think there is certainly an element of that. I mean, I think since the advent of the internet, we've seen this really unusual shift of power. If you look across sort of different social structures, like the media, for instance, it was just the few talking to the many, and there was very little right to reply. The same with celebrities. It was that one celebrity, they would be broadcast on your television, and you could only shout back at your television screen. The internet's given an ability to respond, and even to respond right to that person in a way that I don't think we've ever seen before, so that you can send a tweet and someone like Stephen Fry may read the tweet that says, you know, as in the past when someone tweeted and said his tweets were getting very boring, and he responded directly to that person and said, well, your timeline is hardly a bag of fun too, and then all of his followers pounced on that poor individual. So we do actually have this ability now to get right back to the person who before would be completely unreachable and possibly even injure or wound them as well. If this is someone like a controversial figure like, for instance, Justin Bieber, you can imagine how people will be, you know, inundating his account with hatred and with compliments too, trying to reach him.
Is this the equivalent of screaming at the TV? I mean, in the olden days, you used to be able to scream at the TV and they would never hear you, so you could scream whatever you like. Do we have, as a society, to have more responsibility about basically screaming our opinions at people who may or may not be injured by these opinions?
I think there has to be more of a recognition that what you can say, what you say can actually be heard by that person. I think certainly with the example of Stephen Fry and the individual who said that his tweets were very boring and Stephen Fry then responded, I think probably that person had no clue that Stephen Fry would ever read that, and you know, probably thought, you know, there are thousands of people tweeting at him all the time. He's very famous. He's got millions of followers. Why is he ever going to read my tweet? And I think when we sort of, it's like with the shouting at the television, you have no concept that that person might hear. And because you have that sort of convenient blinkered vision, you forget that they have feelings, that what if they did hear, how would they feel? How would you feel if somebody randomly shouted something like that at you? So I think it gives a very easy disconnect from you as a human being to the other person. You know, it's easier to forget even more so as a celebrity that they're a human and that they have real feelings and that you could actually hurt them.
We've generally been talking about the UK here. What's the kind of international view on trolling? Is it any different in different countries? I mean, the internet is a global thing. So we're not really hampered by our borders here.
There do seem to be some interesting cultural differences in trolling. And of course, you can imagine that some of them will culturally take on the colours of the political scene that they're in. So for instance, in China, there's a lot of talk about something called 50 cent trolls. And this was something that I hadn't come across until quite recently, which are apparently people who allegedly are paid by the government to derail political discussions online, to get people off topic so that people don't coalesce and come together as a sort of a force that might oppose the government. And the term 50 cent apparently comes from every success that they have. They get paid 50 cents. So in some countries, we do find, for instance, one of the little projects that I've got going on at the side is on the Indian tweets that were sent around about the time of the awful rape tragedies that happened in India with the young lady on the bus. And we find very different things going on in that kind of data versus when you look at, say, Twitter data from the UK or from the US. And they seem to be very coloured by the events that are going on at the time, how their particular society set up, and the level or nature of democracy and so forth.
That kind of brought up one question in my mind. We're talking about most of the trolls are individuals. Is there such thing as professional trolling? I mean, do companies ever employ people to actually actively go and troll their competitors, for instance?
There is something that has come up that I've seen on a very small scale. I've referred to it sort of informally as industrial trolling. And one of the cases, it was an individual who emailed me quite some time ago now to say that they were a little business. I'll keep all the details very vague. They were a little business, and another identical little competing business had effectively done exactly what you describe. They'd gone on and they'd written horrible things about them. They'd gone on to their feedback site. They'd left horrible feedback with a deliberate attempt to try and bring that little business down, and it'd been quite successfully damaging as well. So it occurs to me that if you've got small individuals who are doing this kind of thing, I would be quite surprised if you didn't have larger businesses who are perhaps a bit more ruthless, who are employing people second and third hand, you know, somewhere very carefully dislocated from their business, to go ahead and do these kinds of things to damage their competitors. It wouldn't surprise me. I don't have any evidence of it, but I could certainly see how that could happen.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
A huge thanks to Dr. Claire Hardacre there. We'll have a link to Claire's webpage on the blog for this week's pod. Thanks too to Charles Arthur and Samuel Gibbs. Remember, for breaking tech news and reviews day and night, just go to theguardian.com/technology. I'm Alex Hearn, and Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.